Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there. Well, I'm here in Belfast with two men who've been at the heart of the most important political story on this island for the past 40 years or more. They're inextricably linked, yet little is really known about their relationship. Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness, thank you both for being my guests today.
Thank you, Miriam.
Listen, I've interviewed you both endless times over the years, but those encounters, usually they've been short, reacting to the news and often confrontational. So today I'd like to try and find out more about you both and about your relationship with each other. First of all, where did you both meet?
We met in Derry. I had been interned in March 1972 and was released, to my surprise, in June. And myself and Dahi O'Connell were taken to meet with senior British government officials. And out of that came a bilateral truce between the IRA and the British. And part of the outworking of that was a meeting in London with Willie Whitelaw. So we did a pre-meeting to work out what would be said. I don't remember if that was in Derry. I don't think that was in Derry.
That was in Dublin.
Yeah. So we met in Dublin. And then subsequently we met in Derry.
What happened was that all of the delegation who were to travel to London were to arrive in Derry. And the arrangement was that a British military helicopter would land in a field at the back of the Shantallow estate in Derry, and that all of the delegation would be taken in what was a blacked-out van from the Bogside area to that area, and we all effectively got on the helicopter and were flown to the RAF, part of Aldergrove Airport, where there was a military plane awaiting, and an officer standing at the top of the steps to take us to London. So we had all Seamus Toomey and Dahi O'Connell and Gerry and myself and a few others. And we all went up the steps, and when we went up the steps, they all passed in, and I was the last one up the steps, but I was the only one that
this is proof that I was a civilian.
I was the only one that this captain saluted. So even though I was only 21 years of age, he knew he was boss.
And interestingly enough, we were over in Leeds Castle, mm-hmm. I think, last year, and the talks went on longer, so they had to charter a plane to bring us all back, and they brought us back to the very same airport.
Where you'd been all those years
ago. That
we flew
into. I mean, it was the guts of maybe 38 years ago or 37 yeah. years ago.
What was the impression, Gerry, for you of Martin? Do you remember him? Like, had you heard of him before?
Well, yeah. He knew I was much younger than him.
We were joking just coming in here to do this interview because we came down Dibbs Street, and I remember addressing a public meeting on the 14th of August 1969, which is one of a series of meetings which had been called to try and draw the IUC away from Derry. The Battle of the Bogside had been ongoing. You know, that was the night before the pogroms in Belfast, and when, you know, the whole story came right onto the, I suppose, national and international stage. And I remember being up and down to Derry once or twice between then and when we eventually met. So I knew of Martin, though I hadn't met him. We were young guys. I mean, I was 22 or 23 at the time, and we were probably quite raw.
Did you like each other?
I think so, yeah.
Did you like him, Martin?
Well, I mean, I didn't know anything really about Gerry until I had met him as part of this enterprise of being part of a Republican delegation that would go to meet the British Secretary of State, William Whitelaw, at Cheney Walk in London. But I had obviously heard from people that Gerry was seen as a major figure within Republicanism in Belfast at the time. As I say, I mean, I was only 21 years of age.
What age are you now?
Well, still 18 months younger than you. But I think at that particular time, I was actually surprised that I was asked to be part of the delegation because of my youthfulness, and didn't expect that I would ever have been on a Republican delegation that would be flown to London. And
they obviously thought you were important enough in the movement to bring you over.
You have to understand the circumstances at the time. I mean,
I was the note taker. He was very senior.
But Derry was in a serious vein and in a state of war. Mm. But, you know, I actually remember at the meeting with William Whitelaw, the one raw note that was struck during the course of the meeting was when William Whitelaw said, after I had said that the British Army had murdered people on the streets of Derry, that the British Army didn't shoot innocent people. And it's quite ironic that here we are, some 38 years on, and the world now knows the truth of what happened on that day.
You grew up in Derry, didn't you? Tell me about your background.
Well, my mother was a Donegal woman. She came from Donegal to work in the shirt factories in Derry in the 1940s. Met my father. He was an iron foundry worker. And they lived in a two-bedroom house. There were seven of us in the family, six boys and one girl. Both my parents were very religious. My father was a daily communicant. My mother said the rosary every day, and we said the rosary every night.
Were they very Republican?
They were not Republican at all. In fact, they were could be only described as being Irish nationalists and people who would have been very supportive of Eddie McAteer, who was the leader of the Nationalist Party at that time. What really had a massive impact on me was learning that my father actually participated in the Civil Rights March on the 5th of October, 1968. That was just incredible to me that my father, who was one of the most peaceful and peaceable and decent human beings that you could ever have hoped to meet, felt the need to go onto the streets to protest at the injustices and inequalities and discriminations that were taking place.
And Joe, your family, of course, were Republican. You were steeped in it, weren't you?
Yeah, I wasn't conscious of it growing up. There were 10 in my immediate family, five sisters and four brothers. And on my maternal side, both my grandmother and my grandfather were very active in Labour politics. Both of them were officials in the trade union movement, which was quite uncommon for a woman to be in such a position. And my Granda Hannaway worked with James Connolly. Connolly lived in Belfast right up until 1916 and later was part of De Valera's campaign team when, in 1918, De Valera failed to win the West Belfast seat. And on my father's side, there was an IRB connection going right back a number of generations. And my father and indeed some of his brothers had been imprisoned in the 30s around the time that Tom Williams was hanged in Belfast.
So it wasn't obvious in your family's case that you would have gone in to the IRA?
No, far be it. Obviously the events that were happening on the streets had a major impact on me. And I suppose in many ways, you know, I left school when I was 15. I went to the Christian Brothers Brow of the Hill. But my education really began after I left school, participating in the civil rights marches, listening to the speeches that were being made. And obviously, at the time, you had a situation where the citizens of Derry, you know, almost to a man and a woman, rose up against the forces of the state.
But I suppose what you
and did, you're then propelled into a whole new world, something completely different from what I had experienced from I was born until I was 18.
What I suppose is interesting in your case, though, is some people who witnessed what you witnessed didn't go the path of violence. So do you remember the moment when you, as a very young man, decided, actually, I am going to join the IRA?
Yeah, I remember it was a culmination of events. I mean, the killing of Sammy Devaney, the fact that nobody was even charged with that. There was a massive cover-up by the RUC. You know, I joined the IRA, but I wouldn't say that I was, when I did join the IRA, that active in the IRA until such times as internment was introduced on the 9th of August. And that was really what pushed the buttons for many young people in Derry, the fact that people were, you know, innocent people were being taken out of their homes, brought to Belfast, been subjected to interrogation. I mean, the reports that were coming back to Derry was that prisoners were being tortured. And of course, later the British government were found guilty at the European Court of Human Rights. In my street, there was a man called Jim McBride who lived with his wife, and they had one son. And Jim McBride and his wife had a nephew called Seamus Cusick. And Seamus Cusick was shot dead in 1971 by the Royal Anglian Regiment. Nobody was ever charged with it. Several hours later, Desmond Beattie was shot dead by the same regiment on the Leckie Road, and his body was brought around to the foot of our street. I lived in Elmwood Street. I was in the house at the time, and I remember it distinctly, being told that there was a whole sensation happening at the foot of the street outside the Celtic Bar, and we went down the street and saw Desmond Beattie's body being lifted out of a car.
Were
so that had a massive impact on me, and I have to say I felt very frightened also at the time. even though I was on the IRA.
So were you kind of living a double life? For instance, your mother, do you think she knew you were in the IRA?
Myself and a number of others went up to St Columb's College and took some acid from the college. Father Mulvey learned about that, and that caused a bit of a stir at the time. And so that was the first. My mother knew, and it came as a massive shock to both her and my father that I was involved in this sort of activity.
My recollection of growing up was that the adult population was cowed. And what Martin tells about his father, I think, is very telling, because here was this very quiet, unassuming man going out and making his own little stand.
It was inevitable, though, wasn't it, that you would go into the Republican movement because of your background, more so than Martin, because it was in your blood.
Well, probably so, although I like to think that, and I could be foolish in thinking this, I like to think that it was sort of a free decision. I became conscious of what was happening politically in 64. I was still at school. There was an election. The Sinn Féin Party was banned. They had the Irish flag in the window of an office, a shop, that they rented in Divis Street. Ian Paisley, then a young upcoming demagogue, demanded that the RUC remove the tricolour, which they did. There was a bit of street disturbances for a number of days. And we going back and forth to school, saw all this. By the time 1966 came, and there was a popularisation of the teachings of Connolly and of Padraig Pearse, and there was the big pageant in Croke Park. There was a similar one in Casement Park in Belfast. So by the time it came to 69, and even 71, I mean, I was a fully fledged activist. We were involved in housing action work. We were involved in the civil rights stuff.
I suppose the thing about both of you, which is interesting, other people of your generation chose to go different routes. I suppose, as John Hume would say, people made decisions. And who's anyone to judge? And I spend too much of my life, Jerry, wasting my time asking you, were you in the IRA? Why weren't you in the IRA? But I suppose both of you opted to go the Republican violent route. And now, the years later, as you reflect maybe, do you ever think that was a wrong decision to take, that perhaps you could have gone solely the constitutional route?
I think when you take these decisions, and decisions are always right at the time, what needs to be appreciated, and, you know, and I'm a fan of John Hume's, particularly of the work he did in the peace process, but we didn't have an Archbishop Tutu. We didn't have a Martin Luther King. I know there are people who were pacifistic and who did have an opposition to Republican armed actions and so on, but you didn't have the choice if you wanted the type of change that we wanted, because we clearly...
But I suppose people, to be fair, Jerry, sorry, would say maybe you did have a choice.
I agree. I think people had a choice. And the choice for people was, for me anyway, was to continue to be part of a civil rights protest, which I was always very willing to be. But there came a time whenever the civil rights protests were being beaten off the streets by the police, who were seen as the forces of unionism. And we had a situation at that stage where if the British government and unionism had faced up to all that was wrong in the north of Ireland, then I think there was a peaceful route for people to go. But when you're in a situation which is effectively a war situation, which has been created out of your control, I mean, I went to bed on the 8th of August, 1971, in 5 Elmwood Street in my own house, and I woke up the following morning, internment had been introduced, and Derry was a war zone. So in that situation, people have to make choices, and some people decided that they would, you know, join the SDLP and they would continue. I decided that I was an Irish Republican, that I did not want to live under the misrule of unionism, did not want to live under a situation where the British government were turning a blind eye to all of the injustices that were happening, and that I was going to stand and fight the British Army and fight the RUC. And I don't regret doing that.
I suppose what happened was, and it's always easier to judge in hindsight, that at the end of the day, it ended up with something like T-Ban, yeah, or in Kingsmill, with the IRA saying, would the only Catholic stand for it? And I know the point is, you would say, Martin, you entered it for the best of reasons. But it ended up being a horrible, dirty, and largely, though you wouldn't see it, sectarian war.
I would be the last person to romanticise what happened over three decades. War is a terrible thing, and it's a terrible place for any society to be in. But we were part of a process within republicanism that was determined to bring that conflict to an end and to drive forward to build a better future for all of the people who live in this island. And hard choices had to be made. And whilst I made hard choices when I was 21 years of age, you know, many years later I had to make many other hard choices about what way we would go. Would we see a situation where there would be a continuation of injustice and conflict
and
violence and death?
I hear what you're saying.
Or would we move forward with a process that would change all that?
Okay, and if you go back to the young Gerry and Martin, say, as you said, in the early 70s, I suppose the reason you both have a lot of responsibility is you were, even back then, regarded as leaders. Like, you were taken to Willie Whitelaw because the British government believed they would listen to you. The troops and the IRA would listen to you, right? So in a sense, when you end up with Jonathan Ball and Tim Parry, those little kids being blown up in 1993, there must have been a moment over the decades where, despite all the hardship and injustice you witness as young men, you must have thought, for God's sake, this is grotesque.
No, this movement. In war, many terrible things happen on all sides. The big difference about where the media comes from when they try to explore and dissect what happened is that all of the hard questions are asked of Sinn Féin leaders. The media don't ask hard questions of Margaret Thatcher over her role in the conflict. I remember Gerry and I, and we used to go secretly on quite a number of occasions to London, and we would find ourselves in Chequers with Tony Blair and talking to Tony Blair about how we were trying to move the process forward. And he was about the same age as us, and Bertie was around the same age as us, and we were very lucky that we had that combination of people, and that Blair was showing himself to be the first British Prime Minister in history that was prepared to face up to all of the wrongs that happened. And I always remember the morning, and it was a morning on the week that led into the Good Friday Agreement, whenever Gerry and I met Tony Blair. I think it was 7 o'clock in the morning in Castle Buildings. And he told the two of us that he had read a number of books about what was happening in the north of Ireland. And these are his words, not mine. And he said, we were as much responsible for what happened as anybody else. And for me, that was a big admission.
But what I'm saying to you two, as I sit opposite you today, is you bear a lot of responsibility, which I will get to now, for bringing the peace, but also for waging that campaign of violence.
No, I think the responsibility for what happened rests with those politicians who failed to make politics work and who decided, as the British decided to do, the successive British governments up until Tony Blair, that a military solution was the way to go forward. But what we will not accept under any circumstances is this dishonest attempt to apportion blame for what happened on the shoulders of Irish Republicans. Because the responsibility and blame for what happened, if it's going to be spread, it needs to be spread amongst all of the key participants to the conflict. In fact, you know, the British government, since Ireland was partitioned, I think bear a huge responsibility for what happened.
And nobody's denying that.
Unionist politicians bear a great responsibility. And even Irish politicians in Dublin. I come from a city that felt abandoned by Irish politicians.
Do you ever
right
feel,
throughout the years,
you know,
of partition?
When you met somebody like Gordon Wilson, that amazing man whose daughter was killed in Enniskillen, did you feel guilty when you met that man?
Well, guilty wouldn't be the word that I would use, but I mean, I'm sure Martin would agree, Republicans do have to take responsibility for what Republicans did. If you're talking about why there was a conflict and why the conflict wasn't ended before it was ended, well, then those in the positions of high authority are the people who have to be held to account.
Are you
for that.
All
but yes,
culpable
of course.
In a way? I'm not saying
that.
No, but
listen, Miriam. I mean, the first thing that I did, just as speaking for myself for a second, in terms of trying to, you know, gather up a thread of peacemaking, went back as far as 1977. So it took from then took from them. They were also just reflecting a bit, and I don't know if you'll remember all of this. After the Cheney Walk meetings with Whitelaw and so on, we didn't see each other for a while. I mean, I ended up in prison. Martin ended up in prison. But I remember we met up in Paddy Dock's house in Gordon Abroad and Carrigart not long after being come out of prison. And we were trying to spearhead some sort of an effort to rebuild Sinn Féin and reorganise Sinn Féin. And we went to walk. We went away up the lane.
Just
the two of us.
One of many walks.
And obviously they were reflective times because, see, when you come out of prison, you could go home. Mm. You know, you could get a life. You could, you know, because Martin had been married, I was married, we had a number of children, Clayton had one child. A lot has happened. So you have to continuously, if you like, recommit yourself to struggle and to what you're doing. So this was all the time, you know, an effort to find some other way.
If I'm reading Gerry right, he's talking about the mid-70s. Whereas we have had many walks over the course of the period from the 70s right through until such times as, for example, the Good Friday negotiations, when we used to walk up from Castle Buildings to Parliament Buildings, which was totally derelict at the time, and walk around Sir James Craig's grave and decide that was the only place that probably wasn't bugged in the Stormont grounds, and decide then what our negotiating strategy would be when we would go back on the Castle Buildings. But in many of those conversations, they were very, very serious conversations about the future of this country.
Did you ever disagree with each other? Like, your friendship?
Well, I think that friendship is bigger than politics. I mean, one of the things I've learned in the years is that friendship is one of the most important things you can have.
I think the best way to explain it is that there are many, as you know, political parties on this island, and there are many leaders of political parties on this island who spend all their time looking over their shoulder at their closest friends. And wondering when the move against them will be made. Gerry has never had to do that with me.
I've tried to encourage a coup for years and failed dismally.
Yeah, that's true, because it'd be normal rivalry in any normal party, as we even saw recently in Fine Gael. That is not between you two, or is it? No,
that's because we're not politically ambitious in the way that some of these other people are. I mean,
we existed too much together. You know,
we existed for years with nothing, you know, with no money. No nothing. And even now, as political activists, all of our salaries go to Sinn Féin, because this isn't about money or power or prestige or place. This is about how we can bring fundamental change to a situation that was deemed unacceptable by the international community.
Okay, off that for a moment. Is he your closest friend?
I would absolutely.
Are you best friends?
Yeah, we are best friends. Yeah, absolutely. We have known each other now some 40 years.
Do you ever fight?
No. Well, I mean, we have political discussions, and he might have one opinion about one situation, I might have the other, but we never fall out, and we always endeavour to reach a consensus, and the vast majority of cases we do.
How did you come to the decision that you should be Deputy First Minister? Because in a way, possibly wrong, I always had this analysis that you were the hardliner and that you were the kind of more political animal. But did you mind having to let him be Deputy First Minister?
Well, it wasn't a matter of letting, it was a matter of who was the best person for the job.
But why would you choose Martin over yourself?
Because I think he's more ministerial, more...
well, at the end of the day, Gerry had to decide it.
Yeah.
And obviously he had to decide from what was a fairly strong team that we had elected to the Assembly, who he wanted in different ministerial positions.
But were you surprised that he wanted you to be Deputy First Minister?
Well, I'm never surprised that...
Why did you want him to be Deputy First Minister?
Well, first of all, I mean, apart from what I've just said, that you pick who you think's the best person, we're also about the process of trying to build across the island. And one of the things that has hindered us, particularly in the south, is that we've had to devote so much time here to the north. You'd be amazed. I mean, every so often the politician from Leinster House will visit us here, and they'll just be surprised at the, know, when Micheál Martin was the first Fianna Fáil minister to have spent that period of almost 2 weeks in Hillsborough with us just recently. And I'm sure if you were talking to him, he would tell you it was an enormous learning curve. So part of what I wanted to do was obviously to pick the very best people to do.
So you did more
jobs.
Time to focus on the Republic.
But also it's all consuming, and it isn't just, you know, there are four or five different dimensions to what we are trying to do. And we are trying to create a different type of politics. For 40 years, those people who I talked earlier on have been cowed in 1969. Their sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters have the highest possible expectation, the highest possible expectation. They are now, obviously, there are people on the poverty level and there are people who are, you know, facing great difficulties in their own lives. But, I mean, there is a potential here to change society and all.
Okay, but I want to go back to talking about you two because I'm more interested in you two this morning. We're actually going to take a piece of music now, actually. And interestingly, we asked you separately your first piece of music and you both chose Luke Kelly singing Raglan Road. Why do you both like that so much?
Well, I like Luke Kelly. I was lucky enough to have met him very briefly, once or twice. I think he's just a brilliant singer. We're both independently big fans of Paddy Kavanagh. And it's just a wonderful song, just a beautiful piece of poetry. And Luke sings it better than anybody else.
Luke Kelly there singing Raglan Road. How did you both meet your respective wives? Martin, where did you meet your wife?
Well, my wife is from the Brandywell area of Derry, and I met her in the aftermath of the introduction of interment. People of that generation were thrown together in terms of the difficult circumstances that existed on the street. But we both had a mutual friend called Colm Keenan, and unfortunately, sadly for us, Colm too was murdered by the British Army sometimes after he introduced Bernie and myself. Colm was mad keen for the two of us to go out together, and he was always on to Bernie about the possibility of her going out with his friend. And eventually he organised a date for the two of us, and we've now been married something like 36 years, so there's a lot to answer for, God rest him.
Colm told me that Martin got him to set that up. I met Clad in the White Rock. I met her at a political meeting. That was in 1670, and we bumped into each other in odd time, but we didn't actually start going out with each other until around July 1971, and we were married in August, or with a 6 week sort of courtship, and it's probably a flavour of the times.
It must be difficult though, in a sense, for your wives and your children, because you would both have been away from home an incredible amount of the time. For instance, your wife was the main breadwinner, wasn't she?
Yeah, well, I mean, I should tell you that Bernie and I got engaged in 1973. I had just been released from prison in the south, and she had been arrested and was in prison in Armagh Jail. And I remember distinctly going with a friend of mine to a small shop in Buncrana and buying an engagement ring. And the engagement ring was brought by my friend to the prison, because obviously I couldn't go there because I was on the run from the British Army and the RUC. And by that arrangement, we were engaged. And then
Sounds like a Willie Nelson song, doesn't it?
Bernie was then released.
Active as well?
Yeah, she was a Republican, but she was brought before the court and found not guilty and released. And then I was arrested again and spent a year in Port Leisha prison, was released on the 11th of November 1974, and we were married in the same church as my mother and father in Cockhull and Buncrana on the 9 days later. On the 20th of November 1974.
And we were married in the back of St. John's Church, and I was on the run, and we went on our honeymoon accompanied by two guys who have since died, Tony Bradley and Alex Crowe, came to us to the Belvedere Hotel there just off Parnell Square for, I think, one night. The four of us spent. And I remember there was a big rally on O'Connell Street because of the upheaval, and we just stood on the fringes of it. It was outside the GPO, and we were stony broke. We went in and got a Fanta in one of the little Italian cafes, and I asked the woman for two straws, and we come back up to Belfast again into the middle of it all. But I mean, I often would say to people, that wasn't unique.
You've probably spent more time with each other than you've spent with your wives.
I've spent most of my anniversaries with Martin.
Yeah, we have spent a lot of time together over many decades. But I think both of us would be absolutely agreed that the best times are spent in your own house. And there's nothing I like more when I'm away for very long periods of just getting back to my own house and my own family.
Were you worried? You have one son and you have four children. Were you worried that any of your children would get involved?
I mean, I think people take their own decisions, as I said, about myself earlier on. And I just know it's very important for parents to support their children in whatever they do. I have to say I'm really, really proud of my son, as I'm sure Martin is of his children.
I think in my case, if you consider it back, here we are in 2010. The IRA ceasefire was 16 years ago. That's a long time ago. Mm. And so 16 years back, my children would have been, you know, very young. But I think my children were hugely impacted by the fact that they knew that I was working with Gerry and indeed many others to try and build a peace process and bring about negotiations. And so my children, fortunately for me, escaped all of what we had been through. God knows what life would have been like for them if the conflict had have been continuing. But but not just them, for the children of many, many other people, because, you know, as political leaders, we had a responsibility to try and change the mistakes that other people had made. Remember, the first time I stood for election was in 1982. That's a long time ago. I remember it was an assembly election at that stage, and I hadn't got a clue. In fact, Gerry and I, this was a year after the hunger strike. A lot of people have this notion that that because of the Bobby Sands election, that was the reason Sinn Féin tried to capitalise on it. They've actually got it totally and absolutely wrong. We had always been very conscious of the need to build the Republican Party in the North, a party that was dedicated to bringing about Irish unity. And we had a discussion about whether or not we would fight those elections. And I don't think Gerry was that keen on fighting those elections. And I was the one that argued.
Were you keen?
That we should. No, let me go on, because he then turned to me and he said, well, who are we going to put up? And I says, we're going to go up ourselves. And he looked at me as if to say, are you mad? But we did go up and we fought the election. I didn't know how we would do. John Hume predicted that all the national seats would be won by the SDLP. And I went on thinking I wasn't going to win a seat. And when the count was counted, he and I were returned first past the post over the quota. And it was a big surprise to me that there was such support for Sinn Féin and for me as an individual in the Derry area.
The fact that Martin at that moment did think about you both standing and you didn't, does that reflect a difference in your personalities? Are you
I'm more decisive than him.
He's much more sociable than me, more outgoing. If you're at an event with Martin, getting him out of the room is desperately difficult, because he will engage. I didn't know Martin's father, but I knew his mother very well, and I admired her greatly. Martin has an awful lot of his mother's people
skills.
And just that isn't even skills, it's just a way of
which of you is the best in a crisis? Like
me,
when you
me.
Are?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, because he tends to panic and get flustered and, you know, and I have to sort of calm him down.
If you believe that, Graham, you'll believe anything.
I have to sort of calm him down.
I think best in a crisis, the two of us together.
Well, I'll tell you this. With
our negotiating team, we are the best in a crisis. We went into, for example, the recent discussions at Hillsborough Castle around what was a major issue, the transfer of power of policing and justice from London to the island of Ireland. And this was against the backdrop of various unionist politicians saying that they wouldn't like to see it happen within a political lifetime. But we had that negotiating team with us that I spoke about earlier, who've been around a very, very long time. And we were very, very determined that we were going to make this happen. And we made it happen. We made it happen because people are inclined to make this huge mistake that it's the Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness show. Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness are nothing without the people who have been around us and have been wise counsels to us over many, many years.
Is there a bit of hard cop, soft cop? I know that's a bit of a cliche.
It is a bit of a cliche, but it works the way that Martin has said. Obviously, at different points, somebody has to call it. But we always try to go for consensus, and we do have a very experienced team. So it isn't so much, sometimes there are hard negotiations and sometimes there are soft negotiations. One of the best things, I was telling Martin, or I gave Martin a tree there just last about two weeks ago.
You love trees, don't you?
Yeah.
Hug trees, someone said.
I do hug trees, yes. And I'm not at all embarrassed about admitting it. In fact, I've got other people to hug trees in private. But I give him a tree and I was explaining to him. We were in Checkers one time and I've taken a lot of seeds from great houses all over these islands.
Stolen these seeds.
No, liberated them for the people of Ireland. But I brought back a whole big pile of rowan seeds and grew them on. And the tree I gave him was the daughter of one of the Checkers trees. And I mean, I have about 12 or 14 of those trees. We actually told the Brits that we sold them to Irish Americans for millions of dollars, but that's another story. But I think that side of it, you know, you go to these places and it is interesting to be engaging with people who, by and large, don't know what they're talking about.
And that's one thing where I do give huge credit to Tony Blair. And not just Tony Blair, but the people around him who were prepared to make an effort to understand the mistakes that the British had made in Ireland over many years. And I think that relationship that we built with Tony Blair and with others within the process was absolutely critical to the outcomes that came. I mean, we talk in a funny way about the Jerry's fetish for trees and so forth, but I remember one time we were in the Weston Park and Jerry and I and Tony Blair took a walk, and as always these entourages come with you but they keep at a distance, you know, and the three of us were walking away there and he took this notion that he wanted to hug this tree which looked to be about 300 years old, and the tree was absolutely massive. So there he was standing with his arms around the tree, and I said to one of the civil servants, go and get me a camera. And I said, Tony, you hug the other side of the tree. So I have this fantastic photograph, which will not yet see the light of day, of the both of them hugging a tree in Weston Park. But This is an important aspect of it, because you're talking about relationships. And the reality that building relationships within the process, whether it be us building a relationship with Tony Blair or with the Taoiseach or many others who were involved in the process, was absolutely critical to it. And that's why, you know, you asked the question about good cop, bad cop. Whenever he and I go into meetings, and normally it's he and I with others that head up, you know, the most critical meetings that took place within the process, I think our naturalness comes out in the course of that. It's not a matter of good cop, bad cop. We're conscious of the fact that when others come into meetings with us, that's what they do.
Is one of you more optimistic than the other? Is one of you more glass half full, for instance?
No, I'll tell you, it's interesting. There would be times in this process where Martin would have his head, we're going to make this work. And I'd be saying, jeepers, we're not going to get them through this, right? And then totally different on a different day, I would be the one that would be saying, we can see our way through this. We're going to make our way through this. And Martin would be, you know, have some scepticism. So it's probably the mix I want to keep stressing the collective and the fact
that it's like a good marriage between the two of you. It works.
No, I think, I mean, from a personal point of view, we've always had a good, personal, very friendly relationship. We've been together so long, we're like brothers. That's just the way it is.
We're going to take your next piece of music on that, which I have to say I was surprised about, the Leonard Cohen song.
Leonard Cohen, I think Leonard Cohen's a very, very good poet as well. And see, a lot of people take it seriously, and it's only when you see him in concert that you really see that it's self-mocking. Mm. It's really, really, really funny. It's ironic.
And why do you like this song, I'm Your Man?
Again, because it's appropriate. And I want to dedicate it to Martin.
Miriam Meets. Listen back at rte.ie/radio1 facebook.com/Miriam Meets.
Welcome back. I'm here this morning in Belfast with Martin McGuinness and Gerry Adams. What do you do on Sundays?
I go to Mass most Sundays. Just as a little period of reflection, you know, and I'm quite sceptical about the Catholic institutions and so on. I would cook if I get the chance. If I was on holidays, I would cook every day on holidays.
Do you like cooking?
Yeah, very much.
What's your best dish?
Probably lamb shank, but I can nearly cook anything. I like wine. I remember, Martin doesn't drink very much, but I remember having this really wonderful experience with him where we were at a wedding and he had been drinking red wine and we were dancing together and I said to him... Yes, right. We were tangoing. And I said to him, this was always an amazing thing for me. I said to him, I think you're drunk. And he immediately became sober. Just immediately, just within 1 second, he became sober. He's not a bad cook. He's a good poet. He's a good poet in the English language. And he's a very, very good
dancer.
Good family man. Dancing, no, not,
Miriam,
not,
Miriam,
not so
he,
much.
He is a great teller of yarns. And what you've just heard is a yarn. He's actually talking about Pat Doherty, the MP for West Tyrone's daughter's wedding. And as usual, he's taking a bit of literary license, but we'll ignore all of that.
You fish, don't you?
Yeah, I love to fish. I've fished from I was 8 years of age, and indeed still fish with the people I fished with then. And I'm blessed by the fact that I have an older friend called Jamesy Cohn, who's about 15 years older than me, and who's one of the best friends I've ever had in my life. And he said to me, I've always fished with worms and bait and so forth, but many years ago he said to me, you know, you should take up fly fishing. And I said, I would never have the time to take up fly fishing to get to a river, and it takes a bit of time to learn how to do it. But he said, we'll do it. We'll go out to the Daisy Field, he said, and you can practice on a football field. And we did, and within a few weeks I had learned the action. And you might find this hard to believe. The first time I ever went to fish for salmon, fly fish for salmon, I caught an 8-pound salmon on the second cast.
Such a yarn.
And I've been hooked ever since.
It's massive.
Yeah.
Are you religious too?
Religious? I wouldn't say that I was as diligent as my father or mother were, but I certainly do believe in God. I was raised within the Catholic tradition, so that's the tradition to which I give my allegiance. I'm very broad-minded about religion. I understand that other people have different views. I respect all of them immensely.
I don't think I'm very religious. You know, the older I get, the more I would sort of dabble in all sorts of, you know, I mean, Buddhism, I think, I mean, I'm a big fan of Jesus. My granny used to say, you know, we're not about licking the altar rails, you know, but there has to be a sense of spirituality, and that's where the trees for me come into it, you know, that sense of nature.
Spirituality.
Of just...
But I think it should also be said that in the aspect of what happened in terms of the conflict wasn't about religion for us. It was about politics. It was about Britain dominating the people that we represented. So throughout all of my life, I have never, ever been sectarian in terms of my attitude to people of other religions. My father, God rest him, was a foundry worker. And he worked with a man called Billy McNeil, who was a Protestant from the Fountain area of Derry. Whenever my father left our house in the morning, his route to work was through the fountain, and Willie McNeil always met him at his front door, and the two of them walked to work together. And they were like brothers. And Willie McNeil was probably the only Protestant that we knew growing up in the Bogside. But he had a tremendous impact on us because he was just one of the most decent human beings you could have ever hoped to meet.
And I know, because we're not going full circle, because we discussed this all at the beginning of the interview, but is it difficult to square that notion that you're not sectarian? Because maybe there are a lot of people listening this morning who are from another tradition who would regard, I suppose, the IRA campaign as sectarian. That's how they see it. That's how
well,
they will
always see
it.
This journey for us has been a remarkable journey. You know, as I said, growing up in the Bogside, the only Protestant that we knew was Billy McNeil. Since the peace process began, I have come into contact with people from all religions and all of the churches, and indeed some of my best friends, absolute best friends, people I would trust with my life, our Protestant clerics from different churches in the north.
You had that extraordinary moment where Paisley prayed with you for your mother and she was very ill.
People thought it was remarkable that Ian Paisley and Martin McGuinness could strike it off so well together. I mean, when Ian Paisley and I sat down together for the first time, Ian Paisley said to me, "You know, Martin, we can rule ourselves. We don't need these direct rule ministers coming over from England telling us what to do." I said, "Well, haven't I been saying that to you for almost 30 years? And I think he and I made a huge effort to build a cordial relationship with each other, not just because that helps us get decisions made and work done within the department, but also because we were very conscious that we had to lead by example, that people were watching us and people were taking their lead from us.
When you say you go to Mass, and I suppose you're spiritual maybe rather than religious, is that difficult to square with the past of the IRA?
No.
I ask that as an honest question.
No,
I
mean, no,
do
not
you
at all.
Want to clean your conscience? Do you seek forgiveness?
No. Well, I think we should all seek forgiveness. I mean, it's very important to forgive. But I long ago forgive people. I mean, I probably did it initially almost as a self-defense mechanism because I want to be, you know, a whole person. I want to be a useful person. I want to be a person who makes the most of the day, and to have something as cancerous and as corrosive as hatred or a lack of forgiveness is just, it isn't good for a person. So I do believe in all of those concepts.
Are you happy at this stage of your lives? Is your conscience clear, in other words, for what happened and what you have done in the past?
Well, I have regrets, as I'm sure Martin has regrets. I don't think anyone could live a full life without not having regrets. I'm sure you have regrets. But the thing about it all is to make the most out, to make the most, to be the most positive, and to understand that out of even the most awful situation, good can come. Please.
Do you almost both feel that you've pushed the peace so much and achieved so much with the peace process as almost a way of making up for the past?
No, I think, I mean, how could anybody be happy and contented about what happened in the North over some 30 years? You know, I am certainly not happy and contented that there was a conflict in which many people, including many of my friends, some of whom were in the IRA, many British soldiers lost their lives. Many innocent civilians lost their lives. How could you be happy and contented that such a situation occurred in your country? What I am happy and contented about is that we have done something which has changed all that and which gives us a very real prospect after, according to your view of history, and for some people it's 800 years, we've finally brought about a situation where there is a real opportunity for this island and the people who inhabit it to step forward.
Some people said it's like the Chinese parties, though. Very few parties on this island have the same people running them as they do for the length of time. You both have
to. I think we're content to, as long as people think that we have a contribution to make to not just the peace process, but to the development of various
Republican parties. You'd be like Paisley. He stayed on to his 80s.
Well, I mean, I think that the work that we're involved in now, we're considerably younger than Ian Paisley was whenever he retired. And as long as people think we have a contribution to make, this is vital work that we're involved in, because building new relationships is of critical importance. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, we are United Irelanders. We are people who believe that for the South to be cut off from the North, or the North to be cut off from the South, is hugely detrimental to all of the people who live on this island.
If, God forbid, Jerry died in the morning, would you give the oration and what would you say about him?
Well, that would depend on Colette and whether or not she would want me to do that. Well, let me say this, and we started, you know, when
you
I was 21.
You could say there's no possibility of that in the morning.
We started when I was 21, this interview. And
that's
I have to say,
we were
speaking about what was happening in Derry when I was 21. When I was 21 living in Derry, I would not have believed for 1 minute that I would have reached the age of 25 because
true,
of the circumstances that existed. I absolutely thought that I would have been killed before I was 23, 24 years of age because we were effectively living in a war situation. And it is one of the biggest surprises of my life that I've reached just a few weeks ago, the age of 60. But I re-emphasise that I'm 18 months younger than Jerry. And if God forbid Jerry died in the morning, I would be very honoured to speak at his grave. But he mightn't like some of the things I have to say about him.
What would you say?
Well, if I was to tell the truth, I would obviously have to speak about his role as Colette's husband, Geroid's father, and being a grandfather. But I suppose most people would be interested to know what would I say about him politically. Well, what I would say is that I absolutely believe that Ireland has produced many, many great Republican leaders. In my view, Gerry Adams is right up there with the best of them.
And likewise for him.
I refuse to answer your question.
He'll talk about my poetry and my fly fishing and my cooking and the fact that I grow herbs.
The fact of the thing is that God spares us with a lot to do yet.
Okay, well, look, thank you genuinely both for being my guests. Thanks to Jerry McCann. My producer was Eileen Heron. Thank you all very much for listening.
Miriam Meets. Podcast today's show at rte.ie/radio1/Miriam Meets.